I did a film study with Ken McCusick. I wish we were doing a postseason show, but we're not. So, Ken McCusick, how are you doing? I think I'm going to classify this as episode one of season two of Film Study with Ken McCusick.
Sounds good, Josh. We could be doing better. We could be heading somewhere for a postseason game after a win in week one. And I think, it really looked like a game they could have won, certainly in Kansas City, with the way it went.
Well, yeah, but that was the whole season. But it's 2018. We get to start talking about next year. I know it's January, but the Ravens have made more moves, I think, to prepare for next year than the Orioles have to prepare for this year. So let's get started with talking. And we've got a special guest tonight.
Yeah, indeed we do. Let me introduce him, if that's okay, Josh. Brian McFarland is someone I've worked with at Russell Street Report now for over a decade. He was there when I first got there in 2006. And he is broadly known throughout the Twitterverse and all other areas of the internet as the expert on the Ravens salary cap. And Brian joins us tonight, and we're going to ask him a lot of questions. How you doing, Brian?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Where can they, where can they find your work and Twitter and whatnot?
Sure. Well, I have Twitter. I'm at Raven Salary Cap. This is my busy time of the year, obviously, unfortunately. I like to wait as long as I can to write my next year's preview article, and they pulled out till the end, but it would have been nice to wait another week or two before having to publish it. But and then all my articles are on Russell Street Report. Just hit the salary cap tab, and there I am.
There you go. Okay, and there's no better place than that beginning of the off-season article is a piece I look for every year from Brian, I should say, and it's probably the best single State of the Ravens financially piece you can find anywhere. So I really encourage you to read that. You're missing out if you don't. It has all kinds of things about where can the Ravens get cap space and other things we'll talk about, but we're going to hit on some of those items, but we can't hit on nearly all of them. So I really advise you to go out that. If you have questions about contract details for the Ravens, all of that is out there as well, provided by Brian. One of the things I like to make sure people understand is Brian puts a ton of work into this, and if you're going to quote his material, make sure you credit him for where you're getting this. And I know that's a bugaboo we've had in the past, but I do like to see that. I don't like people claiming that, well, according to the whatever cap information we have here at CBS, then we knew this, when they really just went to Brian's work. So anyway. Okay.
Thank you, Ken.
One of the big things this offseason, probably the biggest story cap-wise, is that the Ravens have for some time now been borrowing from the future cap, and that's effectively what you do anytime you restructure a contract. You borrow from the future cap, and they've done so in increasing amounts over the past few years. Can you sort of explain that, Brian?
Sure. Well, there was, if going way back, the purge of 2002 was created by restructuring. And what people don't always realize is when the Ravens arrived from Cleveland, they were in cap hell. And they weren't very good. So as a way of trying to make the team better, they kept restructuring contracts. And that allowed them to sign guys like Saragusa and McCrary and Woodson. So finally, in 2000, after winning the Super Bowl in 2001, January of 2001, they restructured everything one more time, and obviously it didn't work the next year. They lost in the playoffs in Pittsburgh, and then in 2002, they cut bait. And from that point on, they've had a pretty clean cap. They have not needed to do restructures. In fact, Steve Bisciotti came out in 2003 or 4, somewhere in that range, and said that the Ravens would never do them again. They weren't going to let that happen. Well, here we get to 2011, and the salary cap with the new CBA jumped back about $10 million, and a lot of teams, the Ravens being one, got stuck. So they've been tight. They had a pretty clean cap prior to that, but they've been tight up against the cap since then. And the last couple years, they have dug back into that well and started doing restructures. And what that means is basically you are borrowing nobody's losing any money, nobody's gaining any money. It's the same amount of money, it's just accounted for differently. And basically what that means is you're borrowing tomorrow's cap dollars to create cap dollars this year. and last year, between June and October, they restructured four contracts. That was on top of two from the year before and on top of one or two the prior year. So the more you do that, the more you're eating into your future cap dollars. And this year, which at one point seemed to be kind of the light at the end of the tunnel, now here we are and they're tight against the cap again because they've probably lost $10 million to those restructures or maybe more over the last couple of years.
So, wow. So that's a lot of dollars. There's two things about what you just said that interested me greatly. The first was that a lot of fans, I think of the 2000 team as being a particularly young team, and they were, generally speaking, very young. They were a little bit older on the defensive line, but the linebackers were very young. The secondary was very young. They think of it as being a very young star team, but they were really on their last chance already to win it when they did, at least with that team.
Yeah, I would certainly say so. I mean, obviously, you know, Woodson, Sharp, they were at the end. Obviously, you could talk about the quarterback and the shelf life of Dilfer, and then obviously Gerback coming in, and Gerback was one of those big pushes again. That was they had planned to get the quarterback that they thought could win it for them again, and Gerback was young enough that they thought they could weather a slight down year, and you know they did that. You know, 2002, they won 7-9, which was pretty good considering what they lose, like 12. I think they lost like 12 starters from the prior year. It might have been more than that. And obviously in 2003, they were right back into the playoffs. So, but they, of course, had expected that to be with Gerback, but that failed miserably.
Mm-hmm. The 2002 team is one of my favorites, and going back over that, part of the reason that made it tenable was because the Ravens had so much astounding depth on the defensive line in 2001 that they were able to go with all young talent. And the young talent was great. It was Kelly Gregg, Adalis Thomas that they had on the defensive line. Marcus Douglas was still around. And then they brought in Weaver as a new draft pick that year. But boy, that was, as cap purges goes, that could be was about as painless as it could possibly be.
Well, absolutely, and they were drafting so well back then. In the 2001, what did they draft? They drafted Heap and was Baxter in 2001, and then Ed Reed came along in 2002. So, I mean, that was quite a haul those 2 years. And Mulitalo was in there as well. So,
Anthony,
you know, those were. So that they were at the top, and they had a bunch of young other guys that were at least contributors. Of course, I guess on the 2002 team they had to be, but so that was, and that might have been one of Bilk's best coaching jobs, to be honest with you, too.
Mm-hmm.
You're mentioning about how that 2001 Super Bowl kind of affected things years later. How is then in 2013, we're 5 years removed from that, is that still, that Super Bowl team still affecting cap-wise the team today?
No, I mean, the 2001 team, that Super Bowl team only really affected the next year because they cut bait. And because they had restructured so many contracts over the prior 5 years. By the time you got to 2012, they really had a relatively clean cap, except for the fact, again, that in 2011, that cap dropped back $10 million. The overall league cap dropped back $10 million, and that caught a lot of teams because they were expecting it. Well, it had always gone up, and it can, you know, and every year otherwise it's gone up. But that year it came back with the new CBA when the owners put their foot down and said we're going to start controlling player costs. So that was the big thing there. And they've since 2011, and they've really struggled. And you know, we can get into the virtues of Flacco's contract or not, but clearly, and that hasn't actually been, the big numbers are really just hitting last year and this year. But obviously, when you're, you know, when you're paying out as cap numbers, you're looking at 20 plus million. That just means less money to go elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's a comment that's made around the league by various franchises. You have your golden moment for 4 or 5 years at the start of a quarterback's career where you're underpaying him, and hopefully you're not still working off the debt from the last guy for the first year there. And you then have some very cheap years. So as great as Jimmy Garoppolo seems to be for San Francisco, they're going to have to pay immediately for him very large dollars. So they won't have those golden cap years from him. And obviously the Flacco years, the first year under the cap, you get only the pro rata portion plus usually a very low salary, right? So it might have been $7-8 million for Flacco's first year originally under contract.
I think it was about $6.8 million, and then it went up to maybe 12 or 14, and then 18, and then they redid the contract when it was supposed to go up into the 20s and made it back down to about 18. And then this year is the first year that we really see the big number, and it's, you know, it's close to, well, I mean, this past year it was like 22, and now it's 25. So, so this is where it really hits. And, you know, obviously, you know, we can talk about what he's got around him. And I know this is a defense show, but obviously next year he's going to have to start playing better, or they're going to be in deep trouble.
Right.
Yeah, it reminds me of a credit card. When you get your first credit card in college and you're really excited because you bought this thing and you got exactly what you wanted, and about 5 years later, you're kind of regretting that you're still paying for that thing originally. Even though you really liked that thing 5 years ago and were really excited then, it pales right now when you realize you're still paying for it.
So, something tells me you're speaking from personal experience, Josh.
I'm just...
It's like paying a long term deal on a starting pitcher, right?
Well, that I wish the Orioles would do, and I'll go into debt for that.
Oh no, Brian! I think Brian and I did 2-1 on that. But I don't like ever paying a long term deal on a pitcher.
Yeah.
Anyway. We'll move on. I want to come back to generating cap space for 2018. We'll talk about that in a minute. But before we do that, I want to talk about Rick Wagner. Because you said something very interesting on Twitter that I picked up on but never followed up about how Rick Wagner's injury, which occurred against the Ravens, might affect the comp pick.
Yeah, well, so when comp picks are determined, basically the first step is that you value it's the yearly average of the contract. And that kind of sets the initial round, and there are obviously thresholds for third round and fourth round and so forth. So Wagner was clearly in the third round, but there are other factors that can move that pick up or down. Postseason honors help move it up. And then playing time or lack of playing time in this case can move it down. And that was what the concern was. Now, thankfully, Wagner got hurt in week 13, I guess it was. So maybe it was 12. So, but it was late in the season. So thankfully, it does not look like the lack of playing time pushed it down. And there are thresholds for that as well. There's overthecap.com, which does league-wide salary cap stuff. They do a real good job over there. They don't steal stuff. We kind of talked about that stuff earlier. I've worked hand in hand with the owner of that site for many years, and they do a great job of projecting the comp picks. And they've got a formula. They've got a computer formula that they've created based on the history, and they're pretty darn accurate. So it looks like, and they figured out these playing time thresholds. So it looks like Wagner will stay a third, thankfully. If he had dropped to a fourth, then he would be offset by Jefferson, and then the Ravens would have only gotten a sixth, because the way it works, the guy you sign, he cancels out a guy the same round or a lower round. So Wagner being up the higher round from Jefferson right now, as it looks, that we still maintain the third. If you remember going back comp picks, the 1 year we lost Baxter and another guy we didn't talk about, Ed Hartwell, they both signed very large contracts and were lined up to be late third round picks, but they both got hurt within the first couple games of the season and ended up not playing, and those comp picks got dropped down at least a round. I think one of them got dropped down to, I think one went to a fourth and one went to a fifth. So that's sort of how the lack of playing time can play in. But thankfully, it looks like we're okay with Wagner.
All right. Well, let's see. What else do we want to talk about? How to generate cap in 2018. So if the Ravens have needs, if they decide this team is peaking, you know, in terms of having a young defense, which we'll talk a little bit about later in the show, but How do they go about generating cap for 2018?
Well, there are basically three ways you can generate cap. One is you extend the player's contract, and when you do that, you basically take his what is generally a large base salary, drop that down to very low, give him a big signing bonus, and then that will lower his cap number for that year. And of course, then you add on years either to the length of his contract or if he's going to be a pending free agent the next year, then it's all new years to a new contract. So extensions are one way. Obviously, cutting guys is another way. There are salary cap ramifications of signing bonuses that the player may have gotten, and portions of those that count. That's what we call dead money. For instance, if they cut Flacco right now, there's no cap savings. In fact, they would actually lose cap space. So he would cost $28 million. So anybody who thinks that cutting Flacco or trading Flacco is a good idea, it's cap suicide. They're better off having him on the roster. Even if he didn't play, they're better off having him on the roster. So
now is there a 2-year cost to that? I just want to stop you on Flacco here for a second.
Sure. If he's released after June 1st, then there's a 2-year cost. If he's released prior to June 1st, then all the dead money hits all in that year. And sometimes that makes sense because then you don't have a lingering cost. They could release, I guess conceivably they can release Flacco after June 1st of this year if that was their inclination. It really doesn't provide them cap savings until June, because when you release a guy post June 1, or you can actually release two guys prior to June 1 using the June 1 designation, but you don't realize the cap savings until June 1. So Flacco was released post June 1. It would be basically $13 million in dead money this year, $16 million next year, and there would be $12 million in cap savings. But again, you wouldn't see that money till June 1. And these days, you know, June 1 used to be a day when the next round of free agency started. Well, these days, because most teams have so much cap money, they're not worried about trying to split that dead money. Only a team like the Ravens, or when you are releasing somebody with a huge cap number, does post June 1 make any sense anymore.
Okay, I my question is actually slightly different, although I'm glad you explained that, because that's a really important thing to understand about post June 1. But my thing was, Flacco has a 2018 salary, and I don't know what it is, but he has some significant 2018 salary probably. If you cut him this year, and then you look at this, at the cost of it over a 2-year period, you do actually save his 2018 salary. It's kind of like borrowing from the past instead of borrowing from the future, the way I would describe it.
Well, yes. If he's cut prior to June 1, then he's totally off the books in the future. So they deal with everything this year. Again, they would take an extra $4 million hit. So it's basically, as opposed to a $25 million cap number, it would be a $29 million dead money hit. But next year he is totally off the books at that point. Yes. Yeah, so in 2019, there's no lingering cost, either cash wise because none of his money is guaranteed anymore, or cap wise.
All right. Yeah. All right. So anyway, go ahead, Josh.
As we're on Flacco, I've heard a few people talk about how this could be Flacco's last year in Baltimore, and is that all about that cap savings?
Yes. I mean the real. The first, economically, at least cap. Well, let me do it two different ways. Cap wise, the earliest he could be conceivably, at least in my opinion, released would be a June 1 release in 2019. The reason I say that is because that is the point that you can. Again, you don't get any cap savings till June. But at that point, his dead money is less. And this is the last year of all the dead money, all the bonus prorations from his first contract. So that's huge, because at this point, if he was released June 1 of 2019, then there's $8 million in dead money in 19 and $8 million in dead money in 20. Now, it doesn't sound great, but it really is would be sizable. Plus, next year in 19. Now, again, they would not see this till after June 1, but they would have $18.5 million in cap savings. And assuming they carried at least $8 million of that over into the next year, then they essentially carry that over to wash away the $8 million in dead money they carried over. So that's a point. I mean, this is a make or break year for Flacco, because I think, you know, there's two factors. Cap-wise, it becomes possible. And the other thing is, because his salary this year is $12 million. That's obviously nothing to sneeze at. But in 2019, again, his base salary is $18.5 million. People pay attention to the cap all the time. They don't pay attention to cash. If Flacco has another year like he's had the last couple, I find it hard to believe that the Ravens are going to shell out $18.5 million in cash to him.
Right.
They'll figure out a way, which, again, would probably... Go ahead, Ken.
I'm just sorry to say the $18.5 million is sort of a good number in the sense, because it represents an amount that you can restructure and also an amount that is a savings if you cut the guy. So you're
absolutely.
Yeah, so a base salary of only $12 million in 2018 actually restricts the Ravens in a big way, and that's why the dead money number, and I'm looking directly at your spreadsheet to do this, is $28.75 million.
They could release him, or they could restructure his contract. 12 is certainly a restructurable number, absolutely. But again, that would be adding more dead money into the future, and I don't think that would be a wise idea at this point. Next, now, let's say he has a fantastic year this year and he has a Super Bowl year, then perhaps, because they're on the prorations from his second contract now and they're not as large as prior years, perhaps they would extend him next year if he had a great year this year. But I think, you know, at this point, if he doesn't have a gangbuster year, not only is it easier to cut him from a cap perspective, but the Ravens, Bisciotti's got to sit there and write an $18.5 million check, or 17 of them during the season. That's a big number. I mean, that's writing him a $1 million check every week of the season. If he's not playing way better than he has, that's something teams don't want to. I mean, you know, if the cap forces them to pay, they'll pay. But when it becomes a point where the cap isn't really forcing you to pay, that's a lot of money to pay for a guy if he's underperforming still.
Right, understood. And that's Flacco's performance in the second half does lend some hope, although his yards per attempt is still fairly low. But in looking at this contract, and you know, if you were to assign a probability of being released prior to 18, 19, 20, and 21, what probability would you assign to each year? I know I didn't let you prepare for this question.
That's all right. You know, obviously it depends on how he plays. If he plays up to his potential, you know, I'll just say near Pro Bowl worthy, he makes it all the way through. If he keeps playing the way he is, or maybe a little better, I would say next year is 50-50. Mm-hmm. And then if it doesn't start improving, I would think the next year then it's just $8 million in 2020, and they would save $20 million. I would think he's gone at that point, which is why I would, you know, we could talk about the draft and where they, you know, where the, if they want to draft a quarterback this year. I don't know that happens this year. It might happen in later rounds this year. In 19. I don't have any doubt it happens, whether it's at the top of the draft because they're going to get rid of him, or and that'll be a test. If they draft a guy in the first round and it looks like they might cut him, that sounds like June 1 is going to happen.
Yeah, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy in that way. And so, you know, there's reasons I like drafting a developmental quarterback, a guy rounds 3 through 6, I'll say, not 1, not 2. In the second round, the guy is already the favorite player in town of every fan out there on Twitter. And it's just not a situation you generally want, you know, to have being talked about in the media all the time. Even Chris Redman, that was a discussion. And when Elvis Gerback was not playing well. So, I mean, it's really not something you want.
No, absolutely. And, you know, for a lot of years, it seemed like they drafted a quarterback in the fifth or sixth round every year. And, you know, obviously Troy Smith wasn't super special, but, you know, he provided decent backup time a couple times he got in. And obviously Tyrod Taylor certainly, I can't remember if he was a fifth or a sixth, but, you know, he certainly has proven to be at least a viable starter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that's the kind of guy you would like to at least see them get in the next two drafts. And obviously, depending on what's going to happen with Flacco, then maybe two drafts or three drafts down the road, you're going into the first three rounds.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, we went into a lot of detail on Joe Flacco, and I think it's clear that this upcoming season, there's a lot of pressure not only on John Harbaugh, but also on Joe Flacco. Let's look at the defense a little bit, and let's start with we started at the beginning of the season, like we do every year, with breaking it down the players into five categories. So let's do the same thing with looking at the defense in these five categories of yours, Ken.
Okay, so let me, a little bit overhead here is that we divide them into five categories. They are young producers. Those are your guys on their initial rookie deal who are helping you beat the salary cap. So effectively, these guys are all pretty cheap, although, you know, some of them might make first-round money. They're all pretty cheap. Second category is your developmental players. Guys on your first contract still, you hope that they can move up into your young producer group, but they're just not there for some performance reason. And we'll go into a little bit of detail on those because each of them is kind of a special individual case worthy of discussion as far as where they might go and maybe ultimately if they may stay with the team. Then you have veterans that are playing for market value. And of course, once you get to a certain point, I'm guessing Brian would agree with this, is that most of your draft value you get from a player really comes during the first four seasons. Because after that, there are some market frictions, but generally speaking, you're paying market value for a player to keep him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, the veterans playing for market value, if they're playing up to their market value, that's fantastic. You love them, and they're the cornerstone players of your organization. The next group is the group you don't love, the veteran cap value concerns. They're the people who are really not playing up to their contract value as it is. And the Ravens do have a couple of those on the defensive side right now we'll get into. And then there's a fifth group, which is transitional players. So you have a lot of guys who are hanging around the roster for one reason or another, but they don't really have an obvious future with the team, and we'll talk about those. I have five guys on the Ravens defense who fall into that category.
You're always so nice with defining that as transitional when I've got much better names for that category.
Yeah, that's what it is, right? All right, well, let's stop at the start at the top again, because the young producers, they're interesting to talk about, but they don't require as much discussion as some of the others. So my six on the Ravens defense right now are Maurice Kennedy, Willie Henry, Marlon Humphrey, Matthew Judon, Michael Pierce, and Tavon Young. And I'm going to go through these real quickly here. Maurice Kennedy, terrific second half of the season after coming back from injury, accumulated 295 defensive snaps. Brian, you look at snap numbers, I know, as well, to get percentage of snaps for various teams and for contract reasons. My snap percentages and my snap numbers are going to be slightly different because I don't include penalties. So if you see differences there, that's the reason.
Right, sure.
Primarily. Okay, so anyway, of the other players that did well, Willie Henry really became the cornerstone of the offense, of the defensive line. He didn't play the first two games, so after that he led the team in defensive snaps on the line and had 54.1% for the season as a whole, which is, that's an Ironman level for a defensive lineman. They asked a lot of him as the only really viable internal defensive line pass rusher the Ravens have. So he's in the best position of that group right now. Then Marlon Humphrey, obviously, I don't think anything needs to be said. He's a number one corner now and one of the best corners, frankly, in the league. And he's the guy we're always talking about putting on the number one receiver for the opposing team. So he's fulfilled his first-round draft status, and we have four more relatively cheap years to enjoy, although he does make first-round money. Matthew Judon had a breakout year in year two. It was pretty darn good in year one, but this year I played 72% of the snaps, so we're excited about that. Michael Pierce, still at 54% of the snaps. He actually, by a thinnest of margins, led all defensive linemen in snaps, 54.4 to 54.1 over Henry. Pierce was more of a rush defense specialist, though, in 2018. So while I'm happy with who he is and how much he's playing, I think he's giving the Ravens less than they maybe otherwise could get, because he really does not provide anything in terms of pass rush at this point. He showed a little more of that as a rookie and less in year two. And then the last guy is Tavon Young, who we all hope will be back in 2018, fresh and healthy and as good as he was in 2016, and able to do some of the things that at slot corner that we'd hoped he would do in this past season. Brian, anything to say about those players from your perspective in terms of their future with the team, or any kind of contract action they should be taking early, or where are you on those guys?
No, I mean, I think they're all, the Ravens, for the most part, have, not done contracts early, depending upon what year they're drafted. When you're drafted, you can't do a negotiation anyway until after your third year. They've always seemed to, if they're going to extend somebody, it's a star. Otherwise, they let them hit free agency and, you know, see where things stand. So I think all of those guys, it's not time in most cases. Humphrey would be the only guy you're probably looking, Judon maybe, as guys you must extend at some point. But they're both obviously in the first and second years of their contracts, are going into the second and third now. So, it's too early to do anything with them. So I think you got it right. They're the young producers. They're the young, cheap producers, I'll even add.
Right. Yeah. That's the exciting part with these guys is they don't cost you much at all. You've got six guys under this young producer category. How does that compare? Do you know about other teams? Is six a good number? Should we be expecting more under there?
I'll start by saying I think it's an outstanding number, but more is that not one of these guys is entering year four in 2018. They're all entering pretty much year three. The one guy who is entering year four I didn't include in the category is Za'Darius Smith, and we'll get to him in the developmental category. But basically, it's a terrific group of young producers. Okay. Brian, do you have a sense around the league of, does anybody have more defensive talent that's this young in relation to the Ravens?
Off the top of my head, I can't think of anybody. I mean, I'm sure there's some teams. The Saints obviously had a tremendous draft this past year. What did they? They got the corner. They got a safety. And yeah, Lattimore, and they got a safety in the fourth round, and their first four picks were just home runs. I would say that certainly, they're one that, just based on those four, Lattimore's all world already. And obviously those can change year to year, I'm sure there are a couple, but I'm certainly, with the way the couple drafts before the last two had gone, this certainly is a very positive sign, absolutely.
Yep. So one undrafted player in the group, the rest of them all draft picks. So, they have spent a lot of draft capital on the defensive side. Not 100% of it has worked out, but I would say, generally speaking, they've built a very solid core. We ready to move on to the developmental category, Josh?
Yeah, that's exciting. Let's move on. And you said Za'Darius Smith just missed out, and he's in your developmental?
He is. So the developmental group is large, which is also a very nice thing, is that you have a lot of players in that group, because oftentimes, and on the offense, the Ravens have a ton of transitional players that really, it's not clear exactly how they fit in. But the Ravens have developmental players. Tyus Bowser, Chuck Clark, Carl Davis, Jalen Hill, Stanley Jean-Baptiste, Bronson Cafusi, Patrick Owosso, Za'Darius Smith, Tim Williams, and Chris Wormley. So that's 10 guys that I would consider developmental possibilities for the Ravens. And we can talk about them individually, but I want to start with your favorite guy, Tyus Bowser. And just to fill you in, Brian, Josh bought a Tyus Bowser jersey, and he did it with the what do they call it, the special colors?
The Thursday game.
The
games.
Color Rush?
Color Rush.
Yeah,
yes.
There you go.
Yeah, the Color Rush.
Well, because he looked outstanding in week two.
He sure did. So that was the game he won Defensive Rookie of the Week against the Browns. And he ended up playing, he had 34 snaps that day, but he only ended up playing 152 for the year. We've been over this a little bit. I'm hoping he's completely out of Harbaugh's doghouse, but he seemed to do a stupid thing every couple of weeks for a while that was getting him put back in, and he was coming back and only playing four snaps or seven snaps. ended with 152. Did some things positively, and I think we saw the ability to rush the passer at times, the ability to play the run at times, and the ability to cover at times. And all three of those separately from a Sam linebacker is, of course, what we want to see. Now, he's playing behind Matthew Judon, so the question is, does he end up playing another position effectively, which I think I'm against. I have to see somehow that they resolve the positioning between Judon and Bowser so that they can get them both on the field at the same point. And maybe it means Judon rushes from the inside on pass rush downs, or maybe he rushes from the other side sometimes. But anyway, I'm hoping that Bowser can get some meaningful snaps where he can cover and rush the passer in this next year. Jump in anytime, Brian. I don't want to stop you. I just want to breathe for a second, give you a chance
sure.
to jump
no,
in.
No, I mean, I'm just, you know, hopefully he's not another one of the second round pick sort of scenarios that we've had too many times. But he certainly looks the part. And actually, compared to some of the other second round picks, his rookie year wasn't as disastrous as some of those have been. So I guess we should, hope for the best with him. But that is the thing, when you draft so many pass rushers over the last couple of years, you do get into the position of, well, you got to play this guy. I mean, there's just only so many snaps that can go around. And, you know, Tim Williams is on this list. And certainly at the defensive end with Gafusi and Wormley, and Carl Davis, you've got a lot of guys there, that young guys that, you know, perhaps it's just a matter of getting some more meaningful snaps here and there, and they can show their worth.
How do you develop these guys when you've got better current players that you can put out there ahead of them in live games? Is it just practicing? Is it readjusting? How do you give Bowser a chance to grow?
I'll give you three ways. Number one is you got the preseason. So you give him a lot of snaps in the preseason, and it is live action against another team, against players who want to play, even if it's not the best players. Number two, you always have injuries during the regular season. And then number three would be you have practice. That's really the ways you have to try and get them some snaps. But eventually, it will all come down to injuries. Somebody will get hurt, and you know, part of having depth, and the Ravens really taxed it at the cornerback position, for example, this last year, is to make sure that you're prepared when injuries come up. And remarkably, like never before, the Ravens were prepared for injuries at corner this year and dealt with it, I thought, very well as the season went on, to have Hill, first of all, take over at the slot, and to have Humphrey available to play some snaps at the beginning, then take over for Jimmy entirely with absolutely no fear involved when he did. To have Kennedy available when he came back, to have Hill available for snaps for Webb. They really did a great job of having players available. I mean, Clark would have been another one for Levine at that point in terms of players who took over. So it's just injuries are usually the way most opportunity comes in the NFL.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of, you know, Willie Henry comes along thanks to, you know, injuries on the defensive line early in the season, whether it was Williams being out for a while or, of course, Irvin getting hurt. So, so that's exactly it. And they certainly have got a lot of depth there. You just hope when they do, you know, when they are needed, they come through and show their worth.
Yeah, it's not like even the guys who were the backup defensive linemen didn't get a chance. Wormley had a 51-snap game against Chicago. It was almost half his snaps for the whole season. He only had 115 for the year. But he was able to get a good opportunity from injury. So I guess I want to go through the list quickly and just make a couple notes on players and let you guys chime in, and then we'll move on to the next segment here. But Chuck Clark, I thought, played well as a backup dime to Levine, ended up getting 50 snaps on the year, and I think we've got a legitimate backup player there in the secondary who like, and he's a very fine special teams player, so definitely Ozzie mold of drafting a sixth-round dime back who can also play special teams. He's, so many of them through the years, he's gotten in exactly that round with Nakamura and Chad Williams. Corey Harris was a cheapie as well. Jerome Sapp comes to mind. Anthony Mitchell. So they all came by this sixth-round or lower selection, and Clark's a match for that. Carl Davis, we'll talk about briefly. So he played 27.2% of the snaps this last year, 281 snaps. He just does not have a lot of opportunity either, because his only real role is to play as the third defensive lineman in a standard set. So when you have four corners on the field, that's when you have your standard set with three defensive linemen and then four linebackers as well. And it's really the only time he gets in the game. He never plays really as one of the two guys anymore. At least he does not do that often. And so his opportunity is sort of limited. He's coming up on his fourth year. I don't think he's in any danger of being cut this year, but I think that the Ravens are probably going to end up letting him walk and seeing with what some of the young players can do, you know, in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're the last two certainly. It were solid, nice solid depth. You know, Davis was a third round pick, so you'd maybe like to see a little more than that. But yeah, I mean, those two are right there. Obviously you can't start everybody, but when somebody gets hurt, you want somebody who can contribute, and certainly Clark with special teams certainly seems to definitely fit that role very well.
Yeah. Okay, well, Jalen Hill was the MVP of the preseason last year. And he was effective in 8 snaps in the second half versus the Vikings, but he only played 15 defensive snaps the whole year, and then he had a very significant injury come up, which probably is going to cost him to miss some of 2018. So he may be a mid-year reinforcement. Now, Brian, I'm sure you could agree with me that that's not all bad to have a mid-year reinforcement you know is coming back.
No, absolutely, and that's, you know, it, from a cap perspective too. You've got it's nice to have that guy in reserve. Because he's undrafted, you actually play at a lesser salary. So, for instance, if he starts on PUP, let's just say he's on PUP for the first 8 games of the season, he's a little cheaper. Because you're essentially carrying an extra guy there, because he's not on the 53. But he is cheaper, and then, of course, when he's ready, if you've got to cut somebody, then you save money based on the rest of the season for that guy. So it's always nice to have that guy, and, you know, certainly it was nice when Canada came back this year, later in the year when he was needed. So especially with young guys, they get a little stronger, and if they're coming off of injury, you got a little time to get them back up to 100%. Before having to possibly throw them in.
Yep, it's cornerback is a position where there's so many injuries in the NFL too. To have a staged roster where you're not having to carry the guy as an inactive is also an advantage. It's a roster spot in addition to the cap space that I'm really cool with.
Sure.
The next guy, another cornerback on the team, and there was a conflicting piece of information I need to make sure I have correct. Stanley Jean-Baptiste is a guy the Ravens picked up, and effectively they picked him up so that they'd have him for next year, added him to the roster, and he never did play a snap at corner. I'm not exactly sure who he is as a player right now, but the Ravens obviously like him. So the question is this, is Baptiste, you list as an exclusive rights free agent, so maybe you can explain what that is. And second of all, he's listed as a third-year player for the Ravens, which would make that his last ERFA year, as I understand it. And I thought he'd be ending and entering an RFA year, but clear that up for us, if you would.
Yeah, the numbers the Ravens on the Ravens website as far as years. He was drafted 3 years ago. Actually, I think he was a high draft pick. He might have been a second or third round draft pick. I'm going to say the Saints, but I could be wrong about that. He didn't even make the second year with them, if I remember correctly. So he's bounced around. So while he's played in the league for 3 years, he has not accrued enough service time during those 3 years to advance to be a restricted free agent. Basically, you have to be on a team for 6 games in that year to get what is called an accrued season. And then once you have 3 accrued seasons, you're a restricted free agent, unless you're on a rookie contract. And then you've obviously, if you've never been released before on a rookie contract, then you have a 4th year on your contract. But so restricted free agents are guys that have been that they can reach that point, are guys that have been cut or undrafted free agents. So that's what his situation is. So one of those years, he did not have enough. He did not get six games on any team in that year, so he basically lost a year, which is why he's an exclusive rights free agent still, which basically means he can't negotiate. He's not really a free agent, and the Ravens have his exclusive rights. So if they tender him, he's theirs.
Okay. All right, and I'm looking at Baptiste on ProFootballReference.com here, and this is incredible. The guy has had 16 transactions already involving him since the Saints drafted him, not including his draft, which is actually in 2014. 2015, 2016, he didn't have any action on a regular season, but he's bounced around New Orleans, Detroit, Seattle, Kansas City, Jacksonville, and now Baltimore, where he also played a game in 2017. So quite a journey for SJB here.
Yeah. Well, I guess he was thought enough to be a second round talent, so teams are willing to give him another time to see if the light bulb will come on. But so far, obviously, it hasn't happened.
No. All right, let's move on. We've got Bronson Cafusi is the next name. All kinds of stuff about his older entry into the draft at age 24, I believe it was. And so Cafusi is now, I got to check his age again, but I want to say he's 27. Could be wrong about that. Let's see.
But he was
about not having sponsors. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, but he was a guy that Harbaugh mentioned wasn't playing very physical.
That's right. So physicality was something that as apparently kept him off the field. And usually when Harbaugh, a lot of things are coach speak, but when Harbaugh has something nasty to say about a player, he's usually, you can take that as pretty much gospel. You know,
if he's said it to the media, he's already said it to the player six or seven times, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, he only ended up paying 31 snaps. A lot of those came in that first loss at Pittsburgh when they gave up all the rushing yards, and that was, I think, where some of that came in. He played 21 snaps. I remember 18 of them rush snaps in that game, so that was the bulk of his playing time. Since then, he just had two games of five snaps each. So, you know, it's interesting because Cafusi is a guy, again, trapped without a position because the Ravens have other options at the five tech, and we've mentioned Wormley or the possibility of having a player like Carl Davis be there on some snaps, depending on what you're doing. But the other position that Cafusi came as a draft possibility was that outside linebacker, was that he could play standing up perhaps. He might be too big for that, but it's interesting to think of him as either a 4-3 end or an outside linebacker, and what could he bring to the team in, that would be different in that way?
Yeah, this is one of those situations that kind of reminds me of Paul Kruger when they drafted him. They at one point they said Kruger was going to be the 3-4 end, and then obviously later in his career they let him play linebacker. So, you get these guys when you're in this 3-4 base sometimes that they seem like a great guy because they could do both, but it turns out they can do neither. Kruger finally figured it out, of course, in his contract year. Let's kind of hope Cafusi figures it out before his contract year.
Yeah, I'd be fine with Kruger-like development at this point because Kruger in 2011 was actually a pretty good situational pass rusher. And if that was all we got out of Cafusi plus a 12-sack year in his fourth year, sign me up for that program right
that's
now.
That's true. Yeah, with the depth they have around, that's true.
So anyway, we'll move on a little bit here. Patrick Owosso does not have ideal size for a linebacker. That's the nicest thing I can say about it. He is smallish for the position at 6'0", 217. He showed some of the same traits we saw out of Zach Orr in terms of a willingness to throw his body around in the run game, which is nice. But I don't think he's particularly instinctive, and that's, again, being nice, as a coverage linebacker. I don't think he's a guy who knows what spot to go to, although he's faster than Correa. Correa was more instinctive in coverage about knowing where he needed to go. Where Correa really broke down was in a lack of willingness to throw his body around in the run game. I think that's really why he lost the job to Owosso this year. But anyway, I'd be very surprised if the Ravens do not draft an inside linebacker to compete with Patrick and Bam Bradley possibly coming back and possibly a free agent signing as well, an inside linebacker. The Ravens got by, and they squeaked through this year with scary, slim inside linebacker depth.
Yeah, and they thankfully stayed pretty healthy there, other than Bam Bradley going out, who was getting rave reviews during camp. And I did see just earlier this week, I think it was, Jeff Zhrebek of The Sun was saying that he was kind of a dark horse guy. He did expect, I think he said he expected they would draft somebody, as you said, but that Bam Bradley would have probably played ahead of Peanut if Bradley had stayed healthy and at least continued showing, you know, what he had shown during camp.
Right. Well, he was active. He was on the roster to start that season, was just playing special teams with Correa and Owosso splitting those snaps. But I agree with Jeff that I think Bam Bradley showed more and has more prototypical ILB size, and I think he's 237, if I recall, mm-hmm. to be playing the run more effectively. And the Ravens have to play a lot of run in the nickel, and when you do that, you only have two outside linebackers, and now the Ravens have, you know, an outside linebacker who doesn't necessarily hold the edge all that well, and two defensive interior guys who are both pretty big. But it's Mosley and Owosu or Bradley, whoever that second inside linebacker to, have to really cover the run plays on those first two downs. And while Brandon Williams was out, you know, the Ravens just showed how exposed they were at not being able to stop the run in those situations.
Absolutely, yeah. Those couple games were, and the last game of the year for whatever reason too, were just not very Raven-like when it comes to protecting against the run.
Yeah, it's definitely true. We talked about that one last week, so I don't really want to get in too well, but the Bengals really figured out how to get Brandon Williams blocked up on that first drive and did, unfortunately, a marvelous job in that first touchdown drive that set the tone.
Right. On your developmental list, you've got Za'Darius Smith, who played almost half of the snaps this season, but he's still under this development section?
Yeah, that's a good point, Josh. I mean, the problems with Za'Darius are that he's playing at a very competitive position. So he's a rush linebacker, really, and so he has to take snaps away from Terrell Suggs. Well, Terrell Suggs ain't giving up snaps. He's playing at a high level. You know, the Ravens want him to be playing. Something tells me that Terrell is not the kind of player who's going to go easily into this night. Like, I thought Lo'Darius Webb did a wonderful job of giving up his job this year. I don't think it's going to be as easy for Terrell to do it. I think he'll try and be an elder statesman. I just think it's going to be very hard for when it happens. But anyway, Za'Darius, in order to get the kind of snaps he has, he had to rush from the inside on pass rush downs, which meant he and Henry are lining up as down linemen effectively, and that's, I think, reduced his pass rush effectiveness. And despite that, I thought they got pretty good pass rush performance out of Za'Darius in the second half of the season, including a long string of very productive quarterback hits and sacks, mostly quarterback hits there, that included a number of turnovers. So anyway, I'm kind of bullish on Za'Darius, and I'd like to hear Brian's opinion on whether or not you think there's a chance that he will get a contract after year four, that he might be a player that they can find at the right salary level.
Yeah, I mean, you wonder, you know, and obviously it depends on what kind of sack numbers he puts up next year. You wonder if he falls into, I just lost the name, the guy that signed with the Bears from, you're right, with McPhee. McPhee seemed to have, was more prolific pass rusher, but he took that inside rush spot. And, I mean, he certainly put up in his last 2 years some decent sack numbers, and he certainly got a very healthy contract. With Za'Darius, I don't know that he'll get that kind of contract. He'll certainly get something out there, and if, whether it's from the Ravens, I guess, will largely depend on what Tim Williams and Bowser do over the next season, whether Wormley can move into that inside pass rush area, and handle that role that makes Za'Darius not as important. So he may be a guy they can, you know, get another shorter term contract out of if he doesn't put up monster numbers and they feel they need him. But you, I guess in a way you kind of hope that the other guys show up over the next year so that you can let him walk and you get a comp pick out of him, or at least have him qualify for the calculation to offset somebody you sign.
Yeah, I mean, I think that may honestly be the best they can do. And again, If they sign him up for the Paul Kruger development program right now, that'd probably be okay. Although Za'Darius has played at a level higher than Kruger did in his third season already. So anyway, right. One more year to go. If it's a 12-sack year, sign me up for that, even if we lose him. But Pernell McPhee, right. You mentioned him. Just broke my heart to lose him because he drove that 2014 pass rush. The incredible pass rush numbers that were put up on the outside, but both Doomerville and Suggs that year, completely driven by the inside presence of McPhee and his ability to get through a double team. Not just usually take that first step and get shoulders turned, which is fantastic. That's all we really need out of that inside pass rush guy is somebody like Jernigan did a lot to be able to get shoulders turned on both sides, create pass rush opportunities via stunt, via a delayed blitz from a linebacker, even to create the one-on-one opportunity next to him with a little bit more space is often good enough. But McPhee actually could beat those double teams as well, and that's why he was such a hot commodity. And unfortunately, like Kelechi Osemele was somebody the Ravens were not going to be able to re-sign.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so we talked about Tim Williams a little bit. He played 119 snaps this year, just 11.5% of the snaps. The fact that he could not get on the field and make more of an impact is disappointing because he is the best pure pass rusher, I believe, that the Ravens have. Ahead of Za'Darius, ahead of even Terrell Suggs at this point in terms of what he brings physically to the position. So hopefully, building up more to the NFL level in terms of size will be a positive. But he's got all the quickness I think he needs right now to make inside or outside moves. He displayed a nice spin move in the preseason. Certainly a guy that I hope the Ravens will get much better things out of and much sooner than some other people would say. Could be still a terrific value pick for the Ravens.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think it was the Cleveland game towards the end. Didn't he go around Joe Thomas like Thomas was standing still, and sacked the quarterback? I think it was the Cleveland game. It was against a very good tackle.
Yeah, it was week
late
two
in the game, and it was just it was just a thing of beauty. And I mean, I was thinking we're going to see a ton of that the rest of the year. Unfortunately, we didn't. But I think, as you said, I think some size will be. I mean, that's got to be his off-season goal, is to add that 10 pounds or so, so that he can just, that he can bang around a little and not just use his speed, but work on his moves where he can bull rush a little more. I mean, that was always the amazing thing I always thought about Doomerville. As small as he was, his bull rush was just incredible. And then he had the speed to go along with it, so it really put the tackles at a disadvantage because he could take them either way.
Yeah, smaller pass rushers, and James Harrison and Doomerville are probably the best two examples in recent years. They really know how to use their size and leverage underneath the pads. So, I mean, they go around the edge, they get holding penalties all the time because they've always got some left tackle's left arm around their neck as they're turning the edge.
Yeah.
It's good to see, and Doomerville certainly he ended up being a pretty damn good signing. Even though he was signed for 5 years, that's what you hope to get, isn't it, Brian? I mean, a couple of good years, and especially when one is a top shelf year the way it was, they really got value out of Elvis, I thought.
Yeah, if you get 3 years out of a 5-year contract, then you can generally deal with whatever dead money is there. Now, quarterback contracts notwithstanding, but for most other players, yeah, I mean, that's what you're looking for, especially when you're signing a guy who's a little, who's starting to hit 30 or approaching 30. If you can get 3 out of 5, you're happy with it.
Okay, so we've got to the end of the developmental section. We talked a little bit about it, Wormley. I think we've hit on everything important with him. Josh, is there any questions you have, or did you want to talk about anything else regarding developmental players or favorites of yours?
No, I'm okay with the development players. I'm excited to move on to these veterans, the guys that really have to live up to their paycheck in order for this team to win.
Well, there you go. And so I've got 6 in that category. I don't know how many I have in that category. I'll just read off the names. Brandon Carr, Anthony Levine, C.J. Mosley, Jimmy Smith, Terrell Suggs, Brent Urban, although he's now a free agent, Eric Weddle, Brandon Williams. That's actually 8 guys. That's a fairly large group, and that's, I think, indicative of a team that's spending a fair amount on their starting defense, that you would have that many guys in this category. But fortunately, most of them are in this category and not in the cap value concern. without us spending a ton of time on this, Brandon Carr is obviously one guy who is a potential cut. What are your thoughts on that, Brian?
I mean, obviously earlier in the year he was playing fantastically, and you wouldn't have thought that was a possibility, but as the year went on, he seemed to wear down or get exposed or just targeted or whatever it was. I certainly think he's a possibility. I'm cautious, though, to say that, because right now Jimmy Smith is coming off of injury. Jimmy Smith, and he's on the list too, his numbers are such that it's unlikely he would be cut. And of course, if he is cut, then Carr's definitely coming back. So I think, and then you've got Tavon Young coming off of injury, and Jalen Hill coming off of injury, and Carr's just—he's not that expensive as far as a starting corner goes. So I would think he stays. I think he provides, especially if, well, I was going to say if Smith could stay healthy for a year, but Carr provides as a number two or a three at this point if Humphrey keeps coming. I think from a price standpoint, he's worth having around, because if it is Humphrey and Jimmy Smith starting the year as your starters, you know, we know how Jimmy Smith is, and God forbid something happened to Humphrey, you'd like to have a veteran guy like that that you could plug in.
Yeah, it is pretty solid to have Brandon Carr as your third outside corner. He meets the aircraft carrier standard. He actually was surprising. They moved him into the slot a number of times this year, which was surprising. When they had Smith, Humphrey, and Carr all in the game, Carr was moving inside to play slot corner. I look at next year, and I think as it'll play out to start the year, I believe it's going to be Humphrey and Kennedy on the outside, with the likelihood of Tavon Young being back in the slot. And I think that's actually the best case situation, with Jimmy taking his time getting back from the injury, or maybe not being at full strength, that they're okay letting him be the guy who takes a third of the snaps instead of two-thirds of the snaps on the outside to start the year. Maybe they bring him in on third downs. Maybe they play him rotationally the way they did this year. But I would really like to see Kennedy on the outside, where his size is really more appropriate to that position than in the slot.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And if you can extend by starting him slowly, if you can somehow get the full year out of Jimmy Smith, that would be fantastic, because that means by the end of the year, he should be, you know, top flight and probably back to your number one corner, hopefully, which would mean, you know, if Humphrey's progressed as well, then you're looking pretty darn good at your starting corners. And if Kennedy's right there and Carr in the wings, then I think you're in really great shape.
Yeah, that certainly sounds very strong. And unfortunately, last year, this time with the plethora of injuries they had in OTAs and early in camp with regard to cornerbacks, and it looked like this was an unsalvageable year in the secondary in a lot of ways. But then they kept coming up with these UDFA guys, and with the return of Kennedy, who I don't think a lot of people had any significant hope for. And I was highly skeptical of Kennedy's ability to move into the slot. I don't know about you, Brian, but that was something I did not think was a natural fit for him. And yet he played very well there.
Yeah, he did. He really did. And when he was drafted, there was talk about him being more of a safety type, but certainly what we saw last year, he looks more like a full-on corner than sort of your hybrid kind of guy that's a corner but's probably supposed to be a safety. He looked nothing like that kind of player.
Yeah, and you go to the last play of the year, he definitely looked nothing like a safety, unfortunately.
This is true.
All right, I want to only hit on one other player here. Maybe we can hit on two, but let's start with Brent Urban on this list. And what do you think the Ravens are going to end up being able to do with him?
You know, that he's an interesting case, because obviously three of his 4 years were pretty much lost to injury. But he was certainly looked like a top flight guy the second half of last year, and certainly the beginning of this year, camp and everything. He looked you know, absolutely bona fide starter. So, you know, he might be a guy that if there's not, I mean, if there isn't a lot of interest around the league, I could certainly see him being back, maybe just a one-year deal, you know, hopefully for him he picks up, you know, where he left off in September and has a great year and then can hit the free agent market the following year and get his big payday. I would think, you know, for him, as opposed to taking just some middling three-year deal, that would make a lot more sense. I'd like to see that happen here. He sounds like he's a guy that, you know, a good team player who works his rear end off. So, you know, obviously this partly depends on Kaufusi and what they think with Kaufusi and Wormley, but there was, you know, there's room for all of them unless they draft another guy in the third or fourth round. So I would think, you know, that would be a guy that you would look to see if you can get back and say, look, you know, we're going to plug you right back into where you were, and, you know, and you can make a lot of money the following year playing in this defense.
What would a one-year contract Yeah, what would a one-year contract look like for Urban?
He would, because he's coming off of injury, there'd probably be some incentives in it. You know, it's hard to say because I can't, because he's been injured so much, I'm not sure how much of a market there will be. I know obviously it only takes one team to say that guy's, you know, a comer and we're gonna get him before anybody else does, and we're gonna offer him a little more than everybody else because we think we can plug him in and he's gonna be that guy. They could get him for kind of like an Anthony LaVine deal, a couple million over, you know, a little over a million for the year with some incentives. If it's a couple year deal, maybe $5 million, $6 million, maybe over a 3 year deal. It's kind of hard to say because I just, you know, it's going to be hard for a team to have a lot of faith in him, though, because he's had so many injuries.
Right. It's really sad to say because it's just one step on a football field to us and looking at it, and an injury is certainly serious. But you know, it might have cost him $20 million in terms of what he might have had in a contract. Yeah. So. Okay, well, I think we talked a little bit about the players playing for market value. They're not getting rid of Weddle. They're not getting rid of Williams. Suggs has got at least another year. We're excited about that. Mosley isn't going anywhere, but he might be signed to a long-term deal. We could talk about that.
That would be with Mosley. When we were touching on the three ways you create cap space, he's got he's playing under what is called the fifth-year option of his rookie contract, which is basically kind of like a mini franchise tag. Since the first round draft picks with the new CBA, you know, took a huge bite out of rookie contracts, this allows them to make a decent amount back. So his fifth year option, which they exercise, is about $9 million. There's no dead money because he's out of his rookie contract. So all the prorations are done with that. So his cap number is all salary, which is a great place to pick up $4, $5, $6 million in cap space on an extension. This is what they did with Jimmy Smith when he reached his fifth-year option. Elam would have been the next one after Jimmy, and of course they didn't pick that up. So this would seemingly be you know, the place to get a nice chunk of change, and not, I mean, and obviously then you secure your middle linebacker for years to come. So it seems like a win-win deal. Because they're tight against the cap, it does provide Mosley perhaps with a little more leverage, because that's one of the spots they're probably going to need to get something done. So hopefully they can come to a number that works for everybody. But like I said, that's a $4 to $6 million probably cap savings. So that's a huge deal right there.
Has Mosley lived up to expectations, or do you, a lot of fans look at Mosley as a disappointment, but I kind of feel like he had to fill in for Ray Lewis. It was a hard shoes to fill, coming in right behind him.
I'll take a crack at that first, Josh, and then we'll give Brian a shot at that next. I think Mosley was clearly hurt this year and didn't play up to his current contract level, let alone his, you know, the contract level he'll be expecting going forward. One of the things that they asked him to do that schematically I think did not work is Pease had a lot of double-A gap blitz setups, which put him in a position where his job is to really cut down on a window by dropping into a zone coverage, and if the throw is over top of him, which it often was, he has to try and cut down on that window. And Mosley is pretty good about understanding where the play is behind him and has had some nice interceptions where a ball's been underthrown and tipped up. But I think the rest of the league is actually kind of wise to that, and they know to target him and to throw over him. And again, it's this kind of thing where if you've ever watched a penalty kick in soccer, you realize just how hard it is for the goalie to stop any ball. It's just, if it's not basically at about 3 feet of height and to his left or right within diving range, he can't really stop that ball. And that's kind of where an inside linebacker is in terms of being able to really stop the passing game. So I don't think Mosley was as bad in coverage as other people think, but I do think his injuries actually really held him back in the run game this year. That's where I wasn't happy with CJ in terms of penetrating it through gaps to make plays. And Brian, what would you have to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, as far as him being a disappointment, I don't think there's any way I would classify him as that. I think he's certainly, I think he was 16th in the draft. I mean, I think he certainly lived up to that over his 4 years. So I certainly have no complaints there. The question then becomes, what kind of money is he looking for on a long-term deal, or what kind of money would he be looking for as a free agent next year? Is he looking, and I mean, you know, you can always say he doesn't deserve top of the market, or you can say this about just about any player other than Ray Lewis and Ed Reed, but, you know, I mean, you know, is he deserving top of the market money? Well, most free agents don't. They're just, it's just, it's their turn. I mean, did Flacco deserve to be the highest paid quarterback in the league? No. But he won a suit. He was coming off of a Super Bowl, and it was his turn, and he bet on himself. So, you know, it when people say that, I kind of cringe a little, because it's just, that's not the way the system works. The next guy up, if he's in the top echelon, and you can, you know, how you define that is beauty's in the eye of the beholder there, I guess. But, you know, the next guy up is the next guy up for either a contract or as a free agent. You know, he's going to set the market or move up or push the market up, even if he's not the best player or, you know, at that position. So, you know, he's going to get paid handsomely, whether it's here or somewhere else. I don't think there's any question about that. So, I mean, from a cap perspective, the prices always go up. So that's just the way it is. But I certainly don't think he's a disappointment. Is he the best middle linebacker, inside linebacker in the game? No. Is he in the top 10? Probably. Certainly top 12. I mean, you know, again, beauty's in the eye of the beholder there. But he's going to be paid probably like a top 10.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll be paid as a top 10. The question is it okay if he makes the third highest money in the game, or should the Ravens really be holding out so he only makes the sixth highest money in the game? Because by the end of this contract, he's going to be cheap. If he comes in at number three or number six, he's going to be cheap by the end of that contract.
Right, as long as he stays healthy. And people complained about Brandon Williams' contract, but obviously we saw what the defense looked like without him, with him and without him. Now, could they have found the guy that could have done what he did for less? Maybe. But, you know, as you said, you know, and Brandon Williams has been other than those couple games, has been a pretty healthy guy over the life of his career. By the time, you know, that contract is done, he's not going to be the highest paid anymore, the second highest paid, or probably the fifth or eighth highest paid.
Sure. All right, well, let's move on to these guys that we need to be concerned about, the veteran guys that are maybe making too much money.
So I only have two guys in this category, Josh. Tony Jefferson and Lardarius Webb. At midseason, when we did the same list, I had Eric Weddle in there too, but as the second half rolled through, Dean Pease used each of those players more in what is their best role their better role. So Weddle playing on the back end exclusively really was an improvement for them. He's too small to be playing up near the line of scrimmage. He was getting killed in the Pittsburgh game in particular, against Chicago with the missed tackle that caused the long run. It really hurt not to have him on the back end. On the last play of the year, it hurt not to have him on the back end. You know, being defending two receivers and having the sticks, I don't think we'd have had a touchdown anyway. It might have been a completion, but I don't think it would have been a touchdown if Weddle was on the back end on that play. So I think he was fine, but Tony Jefferson, Pease never really adapted to what he did well in Arizona, which was to come up and cover the tight end man-to-man. He did support the run game in a way that we would have hoped, and that he was rated from PFF and others as having a very high run grade. But this was not a guy who produced a lot on the back end for the Ravens, and particularly early in the year, they had him in that position, and he's a fish out of water there. So they need to find a way to change his role, perhaps substitute in a pure back end safety on early downs. I'm not exactly sure what the situation needs to be, but Tony Jefferson covering the tight end is what really made him valuable in 2016 before the Ravens got him.
Okay. Yeah, I would agree. I would say, Jefferson, he was the guy I thought was the first free agent in I don't know how long, maybe ever in Ozzie's tenure or career, which is obviously the whole time the Ravens have been here, but he was the first guy who was just out of his first contract that we paid big money for. You know, we always had success with wide receivers, the Masons, the Boldens, which was a trade, but, you know, the Steve Smiths, but Jefferson, was the guy. I was like, they just went out and paid a top of the market young free agent. Hopefully he returns that investment over the next couple of years if they find a better way to, you know, to use him. Tony Lombardi has a source in the Ravens who said, before there was really whispers that they were going to sign Jefferson, said, we got a guy that we are super excited about. And so, you know, that was Jefferson. And so that just, you know, they went after this guy, you know, as soon as the market opened and got this guy. And I just thought, that he was going to be way more than he turned out to be. And I liked the fact that they went and got a guy in his prime. And if you're going to get a guy in his prime and you're going to pay him top dollar, you certainly hope he earns it, but you expect him to earn it. And I just hope they can find a way to, whether it's just, you know, getting used to a new system or who knows what the system will be with Martindale now, but just find a way to, you know, to fit him in so that contract or that idea of let's go get somebody at the top of the market and really pay for him because we believe in him. I don't want that thought to go away now because they feel like they got burned, sort of like the Orioles with, you know, starting pitching.
All right,
here we go again. Yep. So, and the other guy you got on the list is Ladarius Webb, and Ladarius Webb has always been one of my favorite Ravens, but I think his tenure is done. There's a decent amount of cap savings. It's not huge, but you know, they can save some money off of his release. By the end of the year, obviously he wasn't playing much. You expect Jimmy Smith back. You expect Young back. Hill back, and certainly Chuck Clark was actually playing some snaps in front of him. So been a great soldier for him, another guy that unfortunately injuries took too much time away from him from what he could have been perhaps, but you know, just one of my favorite Ravens always, but I do think that this was his last hurrah.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, it probably is his last hurrah, and I thought he took it pretty well going out on his way out. But the other thing about Lardarius Webb is to remember what a great player this guy was in his prime. They talked all year about Jimmy Smith and his passer rating against, and it ended up being around 49, I think, for the year. Lardarius Webb in 2011 was the best cornerback in the game, and including the postseason, had a quarterback rating against of 42 with zero touchdowns, and I want to say it was seven interceptions including the postseason, but it might have even been eight. And It's just one of those years for the ages. It's by far the best year ever by a Ravens corner, including all of Chris McAllister and Starks' career. And, you know, he is one of my favorites of all time as well. I was super excited to get him originally, even more excited when they got him re-signed to the big money deal after 2011. And then, of course, that didn't work out. But he is one of my favorite Ravens. And Brian, I'm guessing you loved that contract, too, at the time when it was signed.
Oh, it was a great deal. That was one. That was a guy that he was a restricted free agent because that's the way the contracts were back then. And his rookie deal was 3 years, and they signed him early, which they didn't wait and let him try to hit free agency. And it was a reasonably good deal. Obviously, once he got hurt and hurt again, it didn't look like such a great deal. But at the time, there were no qualms about it. There shouldn't have been, certainly.
Right. All right, let's get to the last category, the guys that should not return as Ravens that you kindly call the transitional category.
Okay, well, I'm not saying that none of these will return. In fact, I think there's one key guy who will return out of this. I'm just not sure if he's got a job. But my five guys in the transitional category, Brandon Boykin, who I'm not even sure has ever put on a Ravens uniform. Not true. I saw him in camp. He actually was. But he's playing through some significant injuries, and I don't think he'll be back in any form. In fact, I think he's probably, this is his last chance to make a team in the NFL, given what's happened to him over the last few years with several different organizations. Bam Bradley, who could compete for an inside linebacker job in theory, but is coming off a very significant injury. The Ravens are going to have to make a draft pick at inside linebacker, so I think it's less clear that he's even going to have a developmental opportunity, and it's more likely that he'll be a special teams player for the Ravens who can help them. If an injury were to happen to come, you know, we'll be happy to have him on the roster, but I not generally going to believe that he's going to be an impactful player for the Ravens. Kemalek Correa is in this group. He just does not have a position at this point. That's the main problem. Is if he can play outside linebacker, there's five guys doing it. If he can play inside linebackers, the Ravens are in a position where they absolutely must make a move, and I just don't see him being part of the plans at either of those positions. Played pretty well on special teams, probably will finish his Ravens career there. Brian, what can you tell me about the guaranteed money on Correa's contract? Is he going to stick around for 4 years automatically, or do they have a cut value coming year four?
No, he's clear of guaranteed money at this point. So, so they can cut him at any time. There's not a, I guess he's got about $1 million worth of dead money between this year and next year. This year's cap number's $1.5 million. So, I mean, if they cut him this year, there's only about $500,000 in savings. So, I mean, he's not from a cap perspective, he's going to make the roster based on how he fits into the roster or whether he fits into the roster. So they're not going to be afraid to cut him, but there's no cap savings there to push them in the direction of cutting him. So he's a merit guy. Does he merit a spot on the 53 or not?
Yeah, we don't really talk about this often, Brian, or we haven't at least tonight, but in terms of option value, I look at that very significantly for players during their first 4 years. And a player actually has his most option value as a rookie, but as he gets towards the end of that fourth year, when he no longer can be paid under the market value, the option value kind of decreases each year. And so if you want to hold your option for as long as possible, and then if the guy does become a star, you still have the frictional value of him staying with the organization through either a franchise tender possibly for the restricted free agent possibly, or just the fact that he might not want to move and he's comfortable within the system. He knows he's played well in this system. He might not want to leave the team. So I think there are organizational frictions that help with that. But anyway, Kemalek Correa going into his third year next year, his option value is starting to wane.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, and then Albert McClellan, long-term favorite around here. Unfortunately, McClellan has confused me so many times with his ability to be the Joe Orsolak of this team, a guy who can just come in and play almost any position, or B.J. Surhoff maybe is a better example along that line. He could come back, and he could be the fill-in guy at outside linebacker when the Ravens really need a guy who can stop the run if Suggs went down, or he could be that guy at inside linebacker if the Ravens just can't find anybody that works, and they need somebody to be a two-down run stuffer and can then depend on the dime defense for more snaps than they have in this last year. It would not shock me if Albert did any of that, but on the other hand, he's fairly expensive special teams talent.
Yeah, I think I mean he's under contract, so but there is, I mean, it's not a huge savings, but there's a little over $1 million in savings if he's released. So and for a team that's going to be probably looking for trying to find every place they can find cap space, and with his intended role probably to be just special teams, well, there you got a Bam Bradley maybe, that would fill that role as a minimum deal that he's on. And if they're going to, we expect them to draft an inside linebacker. So, that means McClellan's chance on the field is probably even less. So I would think he's probably a consideration. They could, they could cut him his salary, plus he's got some incentives that he could eventually earn if he plays a lot. But I could see him being a guy, his $1.45 million salary, they could cut him, save the money now. If they want to re-sign him in June or July, there's a good chance he's going to be out there. They could probably get him for $1 million then, so they could save a little bit of money on it. But that way, they're going to let the young guys go through OTAs and maybe even into training camp and see how they do. And there's probably a decent chance McClellan can come back at some point if they needed it.
Okay. All right. Well, once they clear up some of this draft space, figure out exactly how much draft space they have, we know they've got major issues on the offensive side, but on the defensive side, where should we expect them to spend some of this money?
We're talking draft capital now?
Yeah, draft capital.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Brian. You can start, Brian.
I was going to say, we've been talking about it, but I think inside linebacker is a place. If there's one glaring hole right now, I would think that is, if there's going to be obviously what Ozzie last year shocked everybody with what he did in the first four rounds with all defensive players. But I would say this year, if there's going to be an early pick, I would think inside linebacker would be that spot. It wouldn't surprise me. It's one of those things. I think every year you should draft a corner, and it doesn't have to be early, but wouldn't surprise me to see another corner at some point. The defensive line and outside linebackers seem so stacked with returning players that I think, obviously you always go, they always go best player. Another thing I think that's unheralded, and I think Ken hit on it a little bit, a true back end safety with range. Weddle's probably, he's here next year. He may not be here in the fourth year of his contract. So that would be something I would be surprised to see in mid rounds, maybe as somewhat of a surprise pick, so to speak. Get that if they can find that center fielder. Those would be probably the three spots for drafting defense. They should have 8 picks before trades and things like that. So if there are going to be defensive picks, those would probably be the three that wouldn't surprise me to see.
Okay, so three. So you're saying corner, inside linebacker, and a free safety.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And I think I would basically agree with that. I don't have any specific round conditions on this, and I think there is a reasonable chance Ozzie will spend the very first overall pick on either an inside linebacker or a safety. I think it's more likely, and the money's better, or the draft capital is better spent on a center field or free safety, because I think those guys are hard to find outside of the first round. The really good ones. So okay. It's a marquee position. And inside linebacker, I just think you're more likely to be able to find a good one in a later round. And also, I don't want to pay top dollar now that they finally got the frickin' dime figured out. I don't want to pay top dollar for a second inside linebacker who can cover. I want a guy who's a two-down thumper and really supports the run defense and can do a little bit for you. Maybe he's a pass rusher, or maybe it's with a little bit of zone coverage. Can do a little bit for you in pass defense, but not a guy who is just a top-end, run-with-any-tight-end kind of Adalys Thomas talent.
Right. You want Bart Scott.
Yeah. I want cheap and good,
Yeah, right. Yeah, that'll be interesting. I mean, if they did draft a safety in the first round, and I haven't looked at much at the draft to see what's there as far as a free safety, but I would wonder. I mean, I know, you know, the Ravens don't force their guys to start, but I would wonder if they would look then to make Weddle available, whether by trade or eventually as a cut. It just seems like, because you know, one of the factors that we haven't really brought up is that if there is a lot of pressure on Harbaugh, and this, you know, it's been, I know people have said it for a couple of years, but this certainly seems to be the make or break year for both Harbaugh and Flacco to an extent. You know, will they draft a guy like that who's going to sit behind your two starting safeties for a long time or for a year, and not provide any value to help Harbaugh keep his job? Now, you could argue that you know, that the safety at some point, if he plays, could help him keep his job. But so that's something I would think would be interesting when you and that doesn't seem to be the way Ozzie's ever drafted. But
well, two words for you, Marlon Humphrey.
Right. Well, but there's an urgency. There's more of an urgency involved this year. And I'm not saying it's not. I mean, Ozzie's always said I'll draft whoever I think is best, and I'll play Jonathan Ogden at guard his first year because I know I'm going to have him for the next 10 years, and he's going to be a Pro Bowler. And, you know, and Humphrey certainly seems to fit into that kind of category. Heap was the same way. But there's a difference this year that makes me wonder whether they would go that direction or not, or whether they're going to want that first-round pick to plug in and play wherever he is, and hopefully that's wide receiver, but that's for another day.
Yeah, I would hope that Harbaugh's control over the draft process would not be such that he would be able to have veto power even over a pick of a safety. I want his opinion Ozzie, but I don't want him to have a final. I want him to have one vote. I want to have the rest of the scouts in the room to each have one vote, and then I want to have one more vote than all of them put together. And we hope it doesn't end up, you know, being 8-7 or 9-8 or whatever. But
right. Now, I agree, but I just wonder if there's, I mean, even for Ozzie, who knows? I mean, if there's some tension there that we've got to produce, or we're all going to be on the street. I don't know. I think it's just an interesting dynamic that may come into play a little more than it has in the past.
How much does the fact that he went so heavy on defense last year kind of force him to go offense this year?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as we've talked to the defensive players, there aren't that many. There's glaring holes. I mean, I think it's only one glaring hole.
Right.
And otherwise, so I would, you know, the natural inclination would be that they're going to be wasting some draft picks if they draft an outside linebacker, unless it's Lawrence Taylor, you're just wasting that pick, and they're not picking high enough where there's, you know, there's that guy you gotta have, because he's that good, like an Ogden was that one year, you know, so, or Boulware was perhaps in his year. But so, I mean, at 16, I don't think there's going to be a guy like that unless he falls, and there's probably some reason he fell, so that they'll be aware of it. You know, none of us fans on the outside will. So I would certainly think with eight picks, you know, I mentioned three defensive players, but it wouldn't surprise me if the numbers come out to that extent. And obviously, who knows how the draft is going to play out. But, you know, five offensive players and three defensive players would seem like going into the draft where you would want to be.
Yeah. All right. Really don't always draft for need, but I would agree. I think 5-3, 6-2, neither of those would surprise me.
Gotcha. All right, let's get to the mailbag portion, and we got like three questions in, all saying, do you think Carr will be cut? And I think we've already addressed that early in the show, but I do want to get to Marcus's question, who is, because we haven't covered the fact that we haven't done a show since Don Martindale was announced as defensive coordinator. They went with the inside guy. With Wink taking over the defense, do we really have the personnel to play that Ryan attack-style defense that he wants to play?
First of all, let me say, I'm not sure what Wink Martindale wants to play. I think the fact that he's friends with Rex Ryan doesn't necessarily mean he wants to play that defense. It could be he's very comfortable with P's way of doing things. Maybe he wants to blitz more. Maybe he was upset about that. But we'll see. We'll see what he brings. I guess in terms of the process is what I want to address here briefly, is that I'm kind of upset with the process as it was. I want to either understand who they talked to before they hired Wink. And there's a bunch of people, by the way, they can't talk to now. Brian, that's correct, right? By tampering rules, you know, teams who are still in the playoffs.
Correct. They could have talked to the teams that had buys. They could have talked to their coaches during that first week when they are on the bye. But once Sunday arrived, it's all done. It's done till that team is done.
Right. What stood out to me is why so quick to make an announcement, even with an inside guy.
Yeah, it's a good question. Go ahead, Brian. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, you can't let your own guy twist in the wind too long. My sense was that they wanted an outside guy, and all indications seemed to be it was Pagano. But there were certainly reports that the Colts are paying him for two more years, I think it is, and his health hasn't been great, and maybe he wanted to take a step back. They're not going to say, they're not going to come out and say, well, we talked to Pagano, but he declined, so we're going to pick Wink. You can't let him twist in the wind too long as your fallback guy. And obviously, I'm sure they're comfortable with him having the job. It's just a matter of the guy I really wanted was Fangio. Obviously, his fate hasn't been, at least as of earlier this evening, the last time I paid attention, his fate hadn't been determined yet. But obviously either he said he wasn't interested on, he's been a guy that's been on several staffs that the head coach has been fired in the last couple of years. So perhaps he, and that's gotta be, that's another consideration, is Harbaugh's got a short leash, and do you want to come in and, move your family and do all this stuff, and then a year from now perhaps be back out on the road looking for another job. So, I think there may be some of that in play as well. And, all those things combined bring us back to Wink.
Okay. I'm going to say one more thing about this, and that is that when they hired John Harbaugh, they sent around to the season ticket holders an absolutely wonderful article on how it was done, what their process was, talked about all about who picked them up at the airport, how the interview started in the car on the way there, the process of going from 7, I think it was originally, down to 2 candidates, and they had Garrett and they had Harbaugh, and I think they really admitted that Garrett was their first choice, and he declined him and took the Cowboys job that left them with Harbaugh, and they kind of went through the machinations there. It had Steve Bisciotti written all over it. And I think Bisciotti may have decided that this hire was not high enough in the organization, since it wasn't the head coach and it wasn't the GM, that he didn't feel like he could imprint in that same way. And I think that was a mistake. I think this hire was so important in terms of handing effectively a Ferrari of a defense over to a new defensive coordinator, that you could have had anybody. You could have had anybody on this earth should have loved this job. Now, Pagano, maybe for health reasons, didn't want it, but Del Rio or Ryan or Fangio would have been good old guard choices. They have every young position coordinator or position coach to choose from to pick the new revolutionary who's going to change the game of football and could do it with some of the talent the Ravens already have there. It bothers me that the process was not more transparent.
Right, but it's got to be... I was going to say, it's got to be that part that Harbaugh's going into this on the hot seat, and then you don't want to bring someone in who you're going to... If there's a chance you're clearing house next year.
I think that's part of it. The other thing I would say, and it's to Ken's point as far as their process, I think that the big difference there is the owner hires the GM and the head coach. The head coach, especially Harbaugh, after all these years, he hires his coaches. And that doesn't mean he can't be forced to do something different or told to do something different. And we've certainly seen head coaches who have quit or said, well, then fire me. I'm not firing my guys. But I think that's probably the difference. It's certainly a fair argument to say, well, Bisciotti should have stepped in on this one. But I think they're giving Harbaugh the rope, and it goes to Marty too. They're giving him the rope to hang himself. And if this is who he wants, you know, I guess Bisciotti thinks he deserves this shot with his guys, but I think all bets are off after this year.
All right, well, fair enough.
All right. Well, Brian, thank you for joining us on an extra long episode of Film Study with Ken McCusick. At the top of the show, we mentioned all your writing that everyone needs to go on over to Russell Street Report and read. What, again, is your Twitter handle so people can get in touch with you?
Sure, it's at Ravens Salary Cap, so pretty straightforward. And this time of year, like I said, I'm on there all the time. And obviously, as we get closer to moves and cuts and things like that, I try to have the numbers out as quickly as I can put them together, or, you know, get the information, because obviously sometimes it doesn't come out immediately as far as numbers go. And then Russell Street Report, as Ken was mentioning, there's the breakdown of every player's salary there. There's the salary cap breakdowns for this year, next year, and past years if you want to go back and look. And then, of course, articles, you know, weekly these days will be coming up.
Right, great. Ken, what do you have up on Russell Street right now?
Okay, so I have this article, basically. The article about the defensive roster breakdown is up there. We'll be looking at the offensive roster breakdown on our next show. Brian, we might want to have you back for a segment on this, but I don't know if we can do another hour and 50-minute show. Josh, we appreciate you being cool with this, but this is a long commute, or two commutes. Somebody's going to be able to play this over. But anyway, really appreciate it. Loved having you as a guest here. Josh, tell us about your show.
My show, Section 336, is going into full swing now as we prepare for baseball season. I think there's like 44 days until pitchers report or something. The Orioles had their mini camp this week with still just two starting pitchers. This past week on the show, we had Bud Norris on the show, former Oriole pitcher from a few years ago, current free agent out there, and talked to him about his time on the Orioles and what it's like to be a free agent, not sure where you're going to work this year.
Is he possibly going to be back with the O's?
No.
Okay.
He is really trying to market himself as closer material, or setup material.
Wow.
And he did really well with the Angels in that role as just a bulldog coming in late in the game. And, you know, the Orioles, we don't really need a veteran there.
Gotcha. Tommy Hunter.
All right. Yeah, that type of guy. Yep.
All right. So, all right, very good, guys.
All right, well, we will return
Thank
on the
you.
Offensive in a couple, maybe next week. We got to give
good.
We got to give people plenty of time to get through this episode. All right, have a good night, Ken. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
All right, we're all.